Community Radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community and supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Don Guerra.
And I'm Leanne Moroz. This is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, October 23, 2018. A special prosecutor will not file sexual assault charges against Indiana's Attorney General Curtis Hill. Later in the program, we'll hear from Bloomington-based attorney Catherine Leal about the special prosecutor's decision. That's coming up in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, we'll hear from Bob Hamill about the first African-American to earn a letter in IU athletics, Preston Eagleson. Eagleson was also the first African-American to receive an IU graduate degree. That story is coming up in this week's edition of the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana. But first, your daily headlines.
1 year ago, the Lawrence County Commissioners voted to discontinue their needle exchange program. Lawrence County was the second Indiana county to discontinue needle exchanges, which service areas hit particularly hard by the ongoing opioid epidemic. Needle exchanges are typically non-governmental agencies that offer clean syringes to drug users in an effort to reduce the transmission of diseases like HIV and hepatitis C. In a statement that would garner national headlines, Lawrence County Commissioner Rodney Fish quoted the Old Testament in voicing his decision to vote against continuing the county's needle exchange program this week in 2017. That program was run by the Bloomington-based nonprofit Indiana Recovery Alliance. Chris Abert is the founder and director of the IRA. He says the alliance was offering needle exchange programs to Lawrence County for free.
They decided not to renew our contract, which was free, and provided services that could potentially save that county millions of dollars. So the first thing that I think about when I'm going back over that is the moral implications of that, of just abandoning a certain set of the population to suffer and die alone, and the culpability of the commissioners in that way. During the time when they were deciding not to renew the contract, they kept saying, oh, we'll do something ourselves, we'll team with the hospital, we'll have a locally run effort to try to reach out to people. And two things about that. One of the co-founders of Indiana Recovery Alliance is from Lawrence County, so we were a local organization. And the other is that they haven't done anything. There's been no even effort to reach out to the hospital to try to help people that are in desperate need, that are vulnerable, and that are detached from services.
Abert says it will take a while for the IRA and the Indiana State Department of Health to analyze the effect of Lawrence County's decision to close their needle exchange program. In the meantime, a hepatitis A outbreak has taken hold in Lawrence County and much of southern Indiana.
Lawrence County was among the worst per capita in hepatitis C transmission, which is why they declared a hepatitis C emergency. And again, the commissioners are sitting idly while a hepatitis C epidemic is occurring in their county, to their constituents and to family members and community members. On top of that, there's also a hepatitis A outbreak that's happening in Lawrence County. IV drug use isn't necessarily a transmittable way for hepatitis A, which is transmitted through fecal matter. But IV drug users, men who sleep with men, and the homeless population are the most vulnerable populations. So what happened was that they lost access to their IV drug-using population. So we had a lot of people who were using IV drugs that we could have administered those hepatitis A vaccine shots to that we weren't able to. And that's something we were able to do up in Monroe County because of a good relationship with our commissioners and our health department.
Abert says regardless of the Lawrence County Commissioner's decision this week last year, he's still hopeful that the Indiana Recovery Alliance will be invited to resume their needle exchange operations.
It's not really a difficult population to reach. It's an easy population to ignore. And that's what the commissioners are doing, and that's why we continue to push for them to reconsider and to allow services to resume.
Intravenous drug users in Lawrence County have had to commute to neighboring Monroe County for the past year to exchange syringes. Rodney Fish still serves as Lawrence County Commissioner.
Donald Trump Jr. was in Indiana yesterday. The president's son was in Greenfield, supporting the election campaigns of Greg Pence, Vice President and former Indiana Governor Mike Pence's brother, and Indiana Republican Senate candidate Mike Braun. Braun faces incumbent Democratic U.S. Senator Joe Donnelly in 2 weeks during the November 6th midterm election. Trump Jr. reportedly addressed a rally in Greenfield for about 15 minutes, imploring voters to treat the midterm as a referendum on the president's nearly 2 years in office. Donnelly and Braun's Senate race is among the most contested in the country, with both National Democratic and Republican committees pouring advertising dollars into the state. A Real Clear politics poll shows Donnelly leading among Indiana voters by 3 percentage points. An Indianapolis Business Journal poll puts the Braun-Donnelly race in a tie. The statistics and probability website 538 puts Donnelly polling ahead of Braun by 4 to 10%. Mike Braun will be in Bloomington for a private campaign fundraiser on October 29th. Election day is November 6th.
The U.S. Forest Service is planning on conducting some 18 prescribed burns across Hoosier National Forest. The Forest Service announced today they are planning to burn some 4,800 acres of land in the state's only national forest this fall. The burns will take place in Jackson, Martin, Orange, and Perry counties in south-central Indiana. The exact dates of the burns are dependent on weather conditions and the dryness of the area. The National Forest Service is expecting to complete most of its burns before spring, but says it's possible they may have to resume burning forested areas if it is a particularly wet fall in south-central Indiana. Wind direction is often a limiting factor due to adjacent roads or private homes. Each of the areas has been identified to improve wildlife habitat or restore woodlands. In some cases, wetlands, woodlands, or barrens are being restored. In others, the fire is used to enhance oak-hickory regeneration or to maintain early successional habitat and wildlife openings. For additional information about the burns, contact the U.S. Forest Service offices in Bedford.
The newly appointed Convention and Civic Center's Steering Committee hopes to recommend an architect to handle the Convention Center expansion before the end of the year. The 9-member Steering Committee was created through a recently negotiated Memorandum of Understanding between Monroe County and the City of Bloomington. It replaces the now defunct Convention Center Advisory Commission. The commission had already reviewed 7 architectural firms for the project and narrowed the field to 3 firms. Now the steering committee will re-review the firms and chose their top 3 or 4 favorites. In the committee's October 22nd meeting, co-chair Valerie Pina said any new design needs to benefit the area's economy.
And I think that there is the question of what can we build here in the area that will truly be an economic generator for this community, where it serves all our local needs, but also actually brings dollars into this community, which is why most of the restaurants and a lot of those people agreed, you know, and were supportive of the food and beverage taxes, because there was a dream that there would be more business.
Pena's comment was part of a discussion about whether the existing convention center should be scrapped in favor of a clean slate. Steering committee member Jim Murphy said he'd always assumed the historic building would be included in any new design, but Pena said she favors scrapping the existing site, saying meeting planners would prefer a convention site with up-to-the-minute technology.
That building worked great because that was all there was. But I'm looking 50 years from now, 75 years from now, where's technology, where, what are we going to be able to do to keep the convention center viable? When you look at what's going on around the country right now, Indianapolis is a classic example of struggling to how to keep some of their biggest conventions because of technology.
Chris Sturbaum represents the Bloomington City Council on the steering committee. He too voiced support for including the historic structure in any expansion plans.
Say that to begin the discussion of this new convention center by saying we're going to tear down a historic building is probably not going to play very well in Bloomington and not be of the character of the city of Bloomington. I mean, you can always find someone that would rather scrape the site and spend $80 million instead of $40 million, but the reuse is practical, it's green, it keeps the character of the community, and skilled architects know how to do work with what's there.
Once committee members identify their top three or four firms, they will ask the firms to present to the steering committee in November. The firms will be given basic information to plan their presentations around, such as usage of space, parking, and a potential budget. Any architecture firm chosen for the expansion project will be expected to lead a public engagement process. The steering committee will not be asking for specific designs. This comes at the recommendation of committee member Adam Thies, who works with facilities planning at Indiana University. He said architectural renderings at this stage can be misleading and encouraged a broader discussion with the architects.
What I would recommend is then it's, could you show us projects where you've dealt with this scale? How might you deal with our existing convention center? Keep it very broad, as opposed to, will you show us a proposal of what you think you will do? That would be a mistake. It would completely circumvent the public process you all want.
Tees also advised the committee to be prepared. The entire project could get uncomfortable.
These processes aren't all happy. There will be tension. If you're not all ready for tension, you're in the wrong business. There will be tension because the dreams will outstrip your budget.
The Convention and Civic Center Steering Committee for Accountability will meet again on November 15th.
The League of Women Voters of Bloomington-Monroe County will be holding two public forums for candidates running for local office this coming Sunday and Monday. The forums will both be held in the Monroe County Public Library on East Kirkwood Avenue in Bloomington. Keith Klein will be acting as the moderator. Questions will be posed by both the panelists and audience members. The Sunday, October 28th forum will take place from 2 to 4 p.m. The candidates for County Council District 1, Ann Boehm and Shelley Yoder, and the candidates for District 2, Ann Collins and Kate Wiltz, will be taking questions. Council District 3 candidate Ashley Pirani will give a presentation without taking questions, since her opponent Marty Hawk is unable to attend. The Monday, October 29th forum will take place from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Candidates will include the District 1 County Board of Commissioners, Seat 8 of the Division 9 Circuit Court, Monroe County Clerk, and County Recorder. Members of the public may submit questions in advance by Saturday, October 27th, by sending an email to the League of Women Voters, along with a note for which race the question is intended. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Leanne Moroz.
And I'm Don Guerra. The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill will not face criminal prosecution, as the state prosecutor announced today. WFHB's Gabe Donnelly reports.
A special prosecutor will not pursue any criminal prosecution against Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill. Hill is accused of groping four women at a party in March, including a Democratic legislator. Hill denies the allegations, although he did not deny touching the women. Special Prosecutor Daniel Sigler, who was appointed by a Marion Superior Court judge, said he considered bringing misdemeanor battery charges against Hill in an announcement this morning. According to Sigler, witnesses gave varied accounts of the interaction and there was insufficient factual evidence for criminal prosecution. Bloomington-based attorney Catherine Lail says the evidence comes down to a he said, she said.
The one thing that you can't ignore is that a prosecutor is an elected official, and in any high-profile case, the decision to prosecute or not is going to be political. We have a special prosecutor from the same political party as the attorney general, and one can't help but to always think what influence did politics have on the decision not to prosecute? We see every day in every county in this state charges filed against people on allegations even less than this. Typically, victims are women. And women are believed when they come forward with claims that they have been the victim of sexual misconduct. Sexual misconduct cases usually occur when two people are alone. And the fact that this occurred in public and was corroborated by so many independent witnesses would tend to think that Mr. Hill should have been charged criminally. And I do take exception to the media reporting sexual misconduct. The allegations against Mr. Hill are actually felonies, and they're sexual batteries. And a sexual battery is when somebody touches another person in a rude, angry, or insolent manner with a sexual intent. And how do we determine sexual intent? By words that are said at the time of the touching in places of the touching. So when somebody, as Mr. Hill is alleged to have done, sticks his hands down the pants of another person, you can infer that there was a sexual intent. And certainly when he makes a comment contemporaneous with a touching, like, you're hot too, you can infer a sexual intent. I have seen cases filed on less strong facts than this all the time. And when I first heard the news that no criminal charges were going to be filed, I thought to myself, first and foremost, this is a political decision.
Hill will continue serving as the 43rd Attorney General for Indiana, the state's highest law enforcement position. Indiana Governor and fellow Republican Eric Holcomb was among bipartisan officials calling for Hill's resignation as early as July. Hill has refused to step down and called the allegations a partisan ploy, which has defamed his character. He has reportedly retained legal counsel while considering a lawsuit against his alleged victims. Lyle says that, while the state will not pursue criminal charges against Hill, his alleged victims can pursue a civil suit.
Yes, they can seek relief in civil court. And I hope Mr. Hill recalls that we do have a different statute of limitations on sex crimes in Indiana. And so this could, just because this special prosecutor has chosen not to file charges, does not mean he could not be at jeopardy in the future. Generally, the statute of limitations on this type of offense would be 5 years, but it could even be extended beyond that. There are exceptions. So, Mr. Hill, you may have skated on this one, but it's not over.
The state's special prosecutor reportedly interviewed at least 56 individuals in the case. Sigler says that included members of the legislature who were attending the end of the legislative session party in March. Sigler did not interview Hill himself. Instead, Hill submitted a video statement. Hill has retained legal counsel from an Indianapolis law firm. His attorneys responded to questions Sigler had concerning the video.
Well, the attorney general obviously wanted to eliminate any aspects that he would have to answer questions. So, you know, scripture tells us that the wicked fleeth when no man pursueth. So why would Mr. Hill refuse to answer questions if he was innocent?
Hill expressed his appreciation towards the special prosecution in a press release, commenting on the diligence and thoroughness taken by the special prosecutor. Hill is expected to continue serving as the Indiana Attorney General. He is not up for re-election this November. As of this afternoon, it is unclear whether or not Democratic lawmaker Candelaria Reardon or the other three women accusing Hill will pursue a civil suit. For WFHB, I'm Gabe Donnelly.
Support for WFHB comes from listeners like you and from the IU Health Foundation, where local gifts stay local. Serving patients for a healthier Bloomington.
Coming up next, the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana.
Monroe County's Bicentennial Committee presents the Bicentennial Journal, stories celebrating the rich history of Monroe County.
This is my Monroe County story. I'm Bob Hamill. Preston Emanuel Eagleson's role in Monroe County history starts with athletics, but extends beyond. He has dual standing that is hard to top. Preston was IU's first African-American letterman, football, 1894, and the first African-American to receive an IU graduate degree. Preston played 3 years of football and baseball as well, but received just the 1894 football letter. In Crawfordsville, for a game at Wabash College that year, Preston was refused service at the hotel restaurant where the team ate. When he heard about it, Preston's indignant father sued on his behalf under an 1885 Public Accommodations Act. A Montgomery County jury, upheld in Indiana Appellate Court, awarded Preston $50 in damages. Born in Mitchell and a Bloomington High School graduate, Preston Eagleson got his IU degree in philosophy in 1896. He served 2 years as principal of the, quote, colored school, unquote, in school-segregated Bloomington on the 6th and Washington site that later became Bloomington's Carnegie Library and exists now as the Monroe County History Center. In 1906, Preston received his history-making master's degree from IU. Later ordained as a minister, he married and fathered 3 children. He was just 35 when he died. His family roots are local legends. Preston's son, Wilson, married Frances Marshall, IU's first African-American woman graduate. Their daughter, Elizabeth Ann, married into the Bridgewaters family, and her granddaughter, Cora Scott Bridgewaters, in 1997, became IU's first African-American trustee. The family that began with Preston's father, Halston, a Bloomington barber, received more than 20 IU degrees. And Preston Eagleson, more than 120 years after he was a breakthrough athlete at IU, lives on in another way. IUPUI in Indianapolis gives an annual Preston Eagleson Award to the student whose essay best advances understanding of the African American experience.
Join us next week for another edition of the Monroe County Bicentennial Journal.
Support for the Bicentennial Journal and WFHB comes from Monroe County and Visit Bloomington. More information about Monroe County's Bicentennial is available at monroecounty200.us.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Andrew McKiernan, Wes Martin, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Gabe Donnelly.
The Bicentennial Journal is produced by Kate Welch with help from Joyce Poling. Our engineer is Tal Rothenberg. Our theme music is provided by Ben Lumsdaine, Scott Schmadke, and Danny Graff. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, I'm Leanne Moroz.
And I'm Don Guerra. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast as well as all other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@WFHB.org.
Stay tuned for Counterspin, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting's weekly radio show, providing a critical examination of national headlines. That's coming up next on WFHB.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB Bloomington Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@WFHB.org. You can become a Daily Local News volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. You can find an archive of past shows and individual news reports online at WFHB.org and catch live broadcasts of the Daily Local News Monday through Thursday at 5 p.m. We are local, longer.